Americans acquired both liberty and freedom from our European ancestors. But Africans, when they arrived in slavery, began to claim both liberty and freedom for themselves. And when they did that, they hugely expanded liberty and freedom.
Welcome back to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, the Executive Director of Cambridge Forum, and today we are honoured to have with us David Hackett Fisher, who is regarded as one of America's most gifted historians. Fisher has just published his 12th book, African Founders: How Enslaved People Expanded American Ideals. Fisher is Warren Professor of History Emeritus at Brandeis University. He's author of such acclaimed volumes as Albion Seed and Paul Revere's Ride. Fisher's latest book, African Founders, shows that Africans and African Americans were actually agents of change in the development of early America. In many ways, his research transforms our understanding of the role that slaves played in impacting several key areas of life, the four most obvious being language and speech, music, and ethics and freedom. We're greatly assisted today through our guest moderator, Joanna Lynn, an associate editor at Simon & Schuster, who worked on this book with David. Welcome to you, David, and also to you, Johanna. Before I hand over to Johanna, I have one question to start off. Can you tell me just a little bit about your own upbringing and the influences which brought you to this place today as author of this remarkable book?
The short of it is I was born and raised in a border state in Maryland, in the city of Baltimore. My father was the superintendent of schools in Baltimore, and he presided over the integration of the schools in one day after Brown versus Board of Education. That whole issue was central to the world in which I grew up. My family had been in Maryland for many years, part German, part English in ancestry, all Protestant of many denominations. One of my namesake, Josiah Hackett, was a locomotive driver for the B&O Railroad during the Civil War, and had the dubious distinction of being shot by both sides as he drove back and forth between the warring armies. So I've always had that sense of being in the midst of many regions and many cultures that meet without ever merging in the state of Maryland.
I'm going to hand you over to Johanna momentarily now. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, first, I want to thank the Cambridge Forum for hosting this event. And thank you, David, for coming to talk to us about the book. As you mentioned, you're from one of the regions, the nine regions that you outline in this book, from the Chesapeake and Maryland area. And you divide the book up into these geographical areas. And you talk about how slavery was really different in those regions. Can you speak a little bit about that and maybe describe how it's different from region to region?
Yes, profoundly different. And that was the subject of another book called Albion's Seed, which was about European, mostly British folkways coming to these different regions. And after they had profoundly different ways of doing so many of the ordinary things of life, but they also had different visions of America. These were the Puritans who were the founders of New England, and these the Dutch who merchants who founded New York, Pennsylvania Quakers, the planters of Virginia and Maryland, and then the Sea Island planters again of South Carolina.
Yes,
they're very and the most interesting group in many ways for me were the French who founded Louisiana, added yet another. They were profoundly unlike each of them, is very special, each with a very a strong sense of who they were and what they were about. And then they founded those settlements. They began to take on a distinctive quality within a generation or two of their founding, and have grown into some of the major regional cultures that we know now in the United States. And then I was very interested, after I wrote about them in Albion Seed, then to write about the Africans who were brought in as slaves to all of those regions in very different numbers and proportions. But there was something, there was a parallel experience that way, which produced very different groups of Africans in these regions. And that was how I got started.
Well, all these people came over from, or were forcibly brought, I should say, over from different countries and regions in Africa, which is something we don't normally consider so much in thinking about slavery. And that developed, I think, because they were from different regions and had different traditions and customs, they brought them to meet the different settlers of the different regions of the United States.
Yes.
And the slavery was different in different regions of the United States. It was different in Louisiana from the Chesapeake region and to New England. Could you speak a little bit about how it was different from region to region and why that happened?
It varied considerably. And we also are beginning to know more. First of all, I should mention just one, I should make a small point about the African trade, slave trade from America. And we have had, we have another great database which made my book possible. It's called the American Slave Database. And what it is, is first of all, an attempt to establish every known slave voyage, every one, thousands and thousands of slave voyages.
Right.
All of this has been done by teams of my colleagues. And Gwendolyn Midlow Hall in Louisiana, who's a great personal friend, played a major role in this with many others. And they established the flow of the population.
Well, there's, your book draws a lot on, you know, a great range of sources, including the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database and forensic pathology and all sorts of oral tradition narratives. But how did they, slavery differ? We always think of slavery as a very monolithic system, and it turns out it's a bit different from region to region, depending on the culture of the populations.
Well, slavery was different, but still more different were the slave owners from one place to another, who had very different purposes. And it was the culture of Puritan New England, which was from the beginning an attempt to build almost a utopian communities that were
Whereas the Dutch, the Dutch were
merchants. They were here to trade. Very different sort of operation, and they dominated the Hudson Valley. Not only New York, but also East Jersey as well. Then the Quakers were unique, unlike any other religious group in America. And they quickly dominated not only Pennsylvania, but also people used to talk of the Jerseys, and that meant East Jersey and West Jersey. Mm-hmm. And West Jersey was had a kinship with Pennsylvania, as also did Delaware Valley. And that makes a distinctive region in America.
And that was
my third region after New England, New York, and then Pennsylvania. And then the next region was the one in which I was born and bred, which is the Chesapeake. It's Maryland and Virginia. These were plantation colonies. One was founded by Catholics who soon became a minority of their own colony. The other was a royal colony in Virginia, and they founded what would be by far the largest state in the Union. The people said that Virginia was the Prussia of our Confederation, and it really did dominate it. Four of the first five presidents were Virginians.
Right. Well, all these different regions had different aims, the populations, and their goals.
Profoundly different. With the exception of New York, all that we've gone through so far were predominantly English. Something changed with another culture that I don't have a separate region for, but it still appears in the book. This was a culture that went into what the people called the American backcountry until Frederick Jackson Turner changed its name to the frontier. The backcountry was mostly Scots-Irish. They came from the north of Ireland, and they were a very separate and special group and a very, very large population.
I think a lot of people will be kind of surprised at the idea that you mentioned this word gift in relation to slaves, that the slaves gifted us. A lot of people would say, well, apart from free enforced labor, what do you mean by that? So could you explain that, David? What do you mean by the gifts that they gave us?
Well, what they gave us, I would say the first gift was a larger idea of liberty and freedom. We think of liberty and freedom as meaning the same thing, but in fact, they are opposites. Liberty is the right to be free of restrictions. Freedom is the right of belonging. People are admitted to the freedom of the city and that sort of thing. And we Americans acquired both liberty and freedom from our European ancestors. But Africans, when they arrived in slavery, began to claim both liberty and freedom for themselves. And when they did that, they hugely expanded liberty and freedom. They expanded its reach. It had been almost a kind of tribal thing for these various groups that came from England. They made it more of a universal idea. It reached out to everybody. And both liberty as independence and freedom as belonging became these expansive ideas. And they grew larger and larger as slaves began to lay claim to liberty and freedom for themselves.
And in terms of leadership, where were they getting their leadership from? I mean,
they generated their own leaders. They were individual Africans who were their leaders. So they weren't led by Europeans.
Right. So you talk about the Chesapeake region as being a very important one, right?
Yes.
So can you tell us about the Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman story there and how that influenced that particular, why did that galvanize people so much in that area, the leadership?
Well, what they did was to insist that the rights that the founders of our republic demanded for themselves should be extended to everybody, even to their slaves. And so when they did that, they changed the meaning of America. They gave a much broader reach to the ideas of liberty and freedom on which our system was founded. That was revolutionary.
Well, along those same lines, I know that the treatment between slaves and masters were a bit different. And so, for instance, the Dutch in the Hudson Valley had a system of what they called half freedom, yes, by which slaves could sort of attain emancipation. And can you speak a little bit about that and other systems?
Well, first of all, to think of what the Dutch were about, they were here to make money. The others had other, the Puritans had other purposes in mind, but the Dutch just wanted to show a profit. Mm-hmm. And what's always amazing to me is to see how Africans were very quick to see what their masters were about, mm-hmm, and to try to turn it to their own advantage. Okay. So what they did was to try to persuade their masters to enlarge the meaning of liberty and freedom so that they could become more free. And they
right. So there was this interplay between the masters.
Yes, that's right. It was very much interplay that way. Mm-hmm. And they were agents in their, they were not objects of their history. They were agents of their history. They actually made a difference. That is, they being the Africans in America.
Right. Were there other systems in which you can speak to in which the Africans were agents of change and of...
Yes. And mm-hmm, it happened in every region and never twice in the same way. But mm-hmm, if we stay for a moment with New Netherland, and they were able to persuade the Dutch that they could make more money if they could give more rights and privileges to their slaves, which they began to win one by one.
And this happened in Louisiana also, did it not?
It's somewhat in, mm-hmm, in Louisiana. That was another story, particularly when they were facing French leaders. Mm-hmm. And it was a different sort of a calculus that they did. The calculus, mm-hmm, was never the same from one region to another. But always Africans are seeking to expand their, they began to discover liberty and freedom in America as ideals that they wanted to pursue, but to do that, they had to enlarge those ideals. And that's what my book is about.
Mm-hmm. There's also sort of thematic commonalities in the book. So the obvious one that most people would immediately relate to, if you asked about the legacy of slavery, is music. Most people would immediately say, oh yeah, I know about Negro spirituals and all these various forms of music, mm-hmm, troubled songs, that continue today. You know, Rhiannon Giddens is recording right now slave songs with new music under the text.
Yes.
So during limited leisure hours on Sundays and holidays, the slaves engaged in singing and dancing, and they used a range of instruments you mentioned in the book, some of which they made.
Yes.
The banjo, the fiddle, the equivalent of the xylophone, and then drums. They made these drums. So slave owners were leery about the subversive potential of these drums.
Yeah. Very terrified by the drums.
Yeah. So what was the implication that there was going to be a revolution or riot?
Absolutely. Particularly in places like South Carolina, where the slave owning class was greatly outnumbered by its slaves. And they lived in fear and terror of their slaves because of all of that.
So was drumming ever outlawed?
Much more violent and cruel system. The reach of what Africans did, it was in so many different directions all at the same time. But they touched so many parts of the social order in these settlements, always looking for levers that could help them to improve their own condition and to escape bondage. Mm-hmm. Wherever they could do that.
Yeah.
And when, in the process, they persuaded or slowly convinced the ruling class to enlarge these ideas of liberty and freedom beyond what they had been at the beginning. And I think that's one thing that Africans did everywhere in America.
Well, getting back to what Mary was speaking about, some of these thematic commonalities and culture, another thing that another legacy of Africans of course is oral traditions and the language. And I was surprised to learn that a lot of the Africans who came here had ability with language, and so they were actually very valued as intermediaries.
Yes. I was always amazed by the speed with which mm-hmm. Africans were able to learn other languages.
Yes.
I think they were much quicker to learn those languages than just absolutely amazing. And they developed a kind of a gift of speech that then they put to work by expanding these languages that they learned. They gave a new range of meanings to it. They introduced some of their own language to these languages.
Right, there's still the Gombo.
American English.
Right, there's still Gombo and some vernaculars that still exist.
In so many ways.
So one of the things that's really interesting is this whole thing of idea of soul and spirituality.
Oh, yes. That's a wonderful idea. Notice how it grows in the hands of Africans. Yes.
I mean, Du Bois wrote the book, you know, The Souls of Black Folk, and you really latched onto that in the book and said it was of immense consequence, the impact on the New World. So can you speak a little bit about what is the difference between their concept of spirituality, which really wasn't adhering to Christian or other theologies that were here in the New World?
Yes. Well, I see it as an enlargement. They hugely expanded them. The soul took on a much more extended meaning in African-American hands than it ever had in the possession of the English speakers in America. When you think of the language of soul in American English today, we can see how it was extended in so many different directions to an idea of soul freedom. I don't think anybody had that idea before African slaves began to take it up. And think how that has resonated through American culture. And when we think about people as soul brothers and soul sisters, and that sort of thing, that adds yet another dimension to the relationship between people, a spiritual relationship between people. And Africans did that in America. They brought that gift of the spirit to what they were doing, and they enlarged the spiritual dimensions of American thinking and American thought. A lot of that came from Africans, and we're all in their debt, I think, for what they did to our culture in that way. It was uphill work for them to enlarge the spirit of Yankee merchants, but they worked at that. And it's just astounding to see how they did that. They tried to enlarge the attitudes of Quakers who were very sectarian. They tried to enlarge their sense of belonging to humanity. And they did that as well. What they did was to expand the consciousness of their masters and transformed American thought about America itself. A lot of that comes from the presence of Africans, not merely just by their presence, but by their ideas of things like soul and so forth.
And also their deep ethical values,
yes,
which really didn't adhere to a particular church. You talked about the invention of racism. There was slavery, and then there was race slavery. You differentiate those two.
And then there was, after race slavery, and then there was racism. And right. The isms come a little bit later in the 18th century. Most of our isms are not here at the start.
So initially, the first slaves were Native Americans, correct? Before the African Americans.
Yes. There were a few, not many. There was not great success in enslaving North American Indians. They were enslaved with more success in the further south, where Native American cultures were more highly developed. And these open Indian populations in the north were very different that way. It varied a lot from the far north till we go further down.
Just talking about the spin-off of history impacting things and traits that linger and integrate and fuse with things. So music is one of them. And then the pidgin tongue of merging different languages. And both of those things came together in the production of Hamilton, which you talk about in your book. Yes. And said that this was a serious work of American history, which I thought was wonderful. And that you said rap and hip hop in the 20th and 21st centuries have enriched the cultural life of Americans and the world in our time. So tell me what you mean by that.
Rap and hip hop are examples in the way that African Americans expanded our consciousness and our thinking about our condition in that way. Also about the way we talk about it, which is what rap is all about. And they enlarged this not only for themselves, but it spread rapidly through this entire country.
Hey, do you want to take that question? We've got some good, really good questions coming in from the audience.
Will your research for your latest book be able to influence what's taught U.S. school children about our history?
I think all that has maybe already happened. We have programs of Afro-American history now. We have departments in every American university, and they have greatly enlarged the curricula of the university. So we've already had an expansion that way. It's been growing. My book is more of a product of that process than something that would set it in motion, because it's already highly developed in the universities. People are really working, have been working at that everywhere.
You don't think the backlash has set us back, the backlash of people rewriting history right now? And
a backlash, you mean against what? A backlash to...
Against teaching real, true history about America, faults and warts and all. People want to seem to gloss over it, cover it up, don't want to make people feel bad. Well, that's not the purpose of history, is it? Yeah. The purpose of history is revealing the truth.
Yes. Well, I think the main problem is to get people... to engage people in reading history by writing about historical subjects that they find relevant to themselves. If we can do that, they'll read this, and they do. That's what some of us are trying to do. That's what I'm trying to do in this book. And as we do that, I think we begin to expand the reach of historical inquiry. And the question is how to write history or how to present it in ways that would actually reach a large public today. And we're still struggling with that. I mean, that's what I try to do with my books. But the question is how to reach a larger public than that. And a lot of my colleagues are working more actively than I in the use of work in other media. And I think I think that's a major frontier, what we're doing these days, trying to extend the reach of history. The other is to reach history on the ground by getting people to study their own histories and getting out. When people do that, they begin to get interested. And that's what we try to do, too. So there's a kind of macro way of doing that. And then there's a micro way of trying to reach people with their own histories on their own ground, in their own families, in their own time. And then we can go from there.
I mean, all of us have discovered some sort of a skeleton in the closet. I know I have. Yeah. Incredible stuff. Right. That was wonderful.
Many people have that discovery. Yeah. So I think genealogy is a very good way in to history for a lot of people. We're also having a considerable expansion in African-American genealogy, which is great to see. And the more we get of that, the more people have a sense of themselves as being part of a historical experience and process. So.
All right, well, maybe we'll go to another question. What is the long-term demographic impact of the slave trade on Africa and on the world?
That's an interesting and difficult question. It was an enormous drain on the population of sub-Sahara. We're talking about sub-Sahara Africa and mm-hmm. in some regions in particular. I don't think it, the short answer is, I don't think it made radical changes, but I'm not the person I'm not an African historian. I haven't spoken to that question. But I think we also had considerable traffic, people, African Americans returning to Africa and on various missions, some to learn about their origins, others to help people in Africa develop their cultures in various ways. And so we began to get a very interesting chemistry that followed from that. And my colleagues are beginning to get interested in the African Americans who went back to Africa mm-hmm. and began to devote themselves to African causes in creative ways.
Okay.
So we can see these carrying with them some American ideals, but with very large African purposes.
Right.
And in the process, they enlarged the American ideals.
Somebody's written here, did the work of Du Bois inspire or motivate this project, your project? And I think you mentioned Du Bois, Douglas, and MLK, if I'm correct, as being hugely influential in your book.
I see them as moving in different directions, those three people.
Go ahead.
But always moving to enlarge American values and to expand the rights and conditions of Africans at the same time. And I think they were working to bring those two goals together. They were also thinking about another problem, which is the problem of race and of racism, which comes later in American history. I don't think there is a lot of racism as an ism in the 17th century. And it grows steadily particularly in the 19th and 20th century. And racism becomes one of the great transcendent evils in 20th century world and leads to horrific things in World War II. And so I think people went to work against racism as the idea of racism grew. We had to develop a way of moving against and beyond racism, which we've been doing slowly and painfully. And it's still an unsolved problem. Racism is still strong today. And it's going to be still a long struggle to expand that. This is something in which Africans are enlarging the thoughts of Americans, not African, about the problems of racism as something which is profoundly destructive of America in all of its institutions. And so that's unfinished business, but more urgent all the time.
So I'm just going to wind up by thanking David Hackett Fisher for his wonderful new book, African Founders.
Thanks Bye-bye. For having me.
Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, and of course you. So if any of you feel inclined to donate, you can just go to the website, cambridgeforum.org. So thank you all for joining us and for your interest in our history, which is ever evolving. And I hope to see you all soon.